Welcome to History 101, Lecture 23, Colonial Conquests. There is a paradox to the 19th and indeed to the early 20th century. As we saw, Europeans within Europe increasingly pondered to the idea of the national state. Yet beyond Europe, those same new national states then began to found precisely the kind of composite multinational and multilingual empires most of them had originally arisen from. This makes for a whole laundry list. Portugal, Italy, Spain, the Netherlands, Belgium, Germany, France, Britain, of course, and Russia, of which the distinctive characteristic was that its colonial expansion was over land rather than overseas, and that the colonial territories it conquered in the 19th century, all the modern Stan countries, were contiguous to Siberia and Russia, yet they were seen as and treated as colonies, and the Russian authorities talked about their civilizing mission there much as the British or the French might. Everybody did so, really, except the Balkan countries, which were deemed too backward and uncivilized to be allowed colonies by the Grand Concert of Civilized Nations, as it was called at the time, and Switzerland, which might well have been allowed a colony had it ever asked for one, as King Leopold II of Belgium did, who was allowed a badly defined area in Africa, stretching to the upper reaches of the Congo River during the famous Berlin Conference of 1885. That territory was to serve as a buffer, ruled by a neutral and civilized, in the jargon of the time, and prosperous country, which might thus duly civilize the natives, again in that jargon, between the various possessions of the great powers in Africa. The only country which paradoxically shed its colonies in the 19th century was Denmark. In the late 19th century, this European list was joined by two non-European newcomers, Japan and the USA, with the Spanish-American War of 1898 and the annexation of the Philippines in 1899, ensuing in a war with the independence movement on the Philippines, on all of which Mark Twain wrote, quote, "There have been lies, yes, but the lies were told in a good cause. We have been treacherous, yes, but that was only in that real good might come out of apparent evil. True, we have crushed a deceived and confiding people. We have turned against the weak and the friendless who trusted us. We have stamped out a just and intelligent and well-ordered republic. We have stabbed an ally in the back. We have robbed a trusting friend of his land and his liberty. But all that was for the best. The head of every state and sovereignty in Christendom, and 90% of every legislative body in Christendom, including our Congress and our state legislatures, are members not only of the Church, but of the Blessing of Civilization Trust. This world-curdling accumulation of trained morals, high principles, and justice cannot do an unright thing, an unfair thing, an ungenerous thing, an unclean thing. It knows what it is about. Give yourself no uneasiness. It is all right." End quote. Those new colonial empires, gathered by that Blessings of Civilization Trust, were all ramshackle and random constructions, the populations of which shared less with one another than those of the Russian or Austrian empires did. For the only thing which linked all those populations were not ties to one another, as rather an allegiance to a brand new motherland. One that was not only commonly located on the opposite side of the globe, but that few or none had ever visited. From 1900 to 1940, on 12 million Congolese, less than 200 had ever been in Belgium, so that to the average Congolese peasant, the spirit realm was probably far more concrete than the motherland was. Far more people, after all, laid claim to having seen the spirit realm than had ever been in Belgium. Thus, the Kingdom of the Netherlands, whose territory in the Indonesian archipelago in the 18th century had still consisted of merely the coastal strip of Java, the Moluccas, and some scattered trading posts in the rest of the archipelago, subdued the whole of Java in the 1820s. And it then extended its rule, in the late 19th century, to the entire archipelago, to create a multilingual, multi-ethnic, and multi-religious empire that was not even so much smaller than the Roman Empire in an area that was later on to be called Indonesia. And it may not be unnecessary to point out that the last territories of modern Indonesia were only subdued and thus included within that empire in the beginning of the 20th century. Bali, for example, only fell in 1906. Given that most areas of the archipelago had been independent for hundreds, if not thousands of years before, and are historically, linguistically, and religiously entirely different from and distinct from Java, far more distinct than the Ukraine is from Russia or Norway is from Sweden or Denmark, the most remarkable thing about modern Indonesia is perhaps not that it has had problems with regional separatisms in Aceh, the Moluccas, or in Irian Jaya after independence, but rather the degree to which it has managed to stick together. Yet the Dutch had at least had some contacts with the Indonesian archipelago beyond Java before the 19th century. And the outer boundaries of Dutch territory there had been fixed by international treaties in the 1820s, so that the Dutch commonly designed what pretty much amounted to a new conquest by the euphemism gebiedsafronding, the filling in of territory within an international boundary by effectively occupying that territory on the ground, as the jargon was at the time. Much like the USA, at the same time, did with the Apaches of Nevada, who lived within the international boundary of the USA, but did not yet recognize the USA's government. So, in the light of this, it is even more striking that over the same time, the small kingdom of Belgium also conquered a huge territory later on called the Congo, with which it had no contacts whatsoever before, the trade in the Congo Basin being previously dominated by the English, by freewheeling Portuguese traders, and by the Dutch Africa Trade Company. Belgian King Leopold II, incidentally, would initially have just as well loved to swap Congo with Hawaii, with Cambodia, with Borneo, or with New Guinea, and obviously never set a foot in his new Congolese possessions. In fact, as King Gorilla, as he was known at the time, was very unpopular in Belgium, he rarely set foot there too. Rather, he spent most of his time in a villa on the French Riviera, which he shared with hordes of ladies of easy virtue and one lover habitually 20 or 30 years younger than King Gorilla, whom he showered in the Congo diamonds after another. It was all accomplished by a private association headed by Leopold at the minimal cost of life and indeed of worries in Belgium. The Congo Association was formerly merely headquartered in Brussels and had as its professed aim to further free trade in the Congo Basin for all civilized nations, for which it constantly tried to lure foreign investors. Though in practice, given all the then, yet mostly unconfirmed horror stories surrounding the association, they by and large abstained from investing. So the shares of the association were in practice underwritten by the Belgian state. And though professing to further free trade, the Congo Association in actual practice made everything, including 3/4 of all the land in Congo, to a so-called private domain of Leopold II that was then auctioned in the Antwerp Exchange to big companies for a sixpence. Yet the conquest of Congo was of small concern to the metropolis too, as there were rarely more than 1,000 Belgians, and the number of Belgian soldiers there was commonly less than 300. Rather than by Belgians, the Congo was run by mercenaries from all over Europe, one of whom, an Italian, described his job as, quote, "murdering, plundering and sacking the inhabitants to line not so much my own pockets but those of Leopold II and a few dignitaries of Belgium, that very enlightened state." Though the Congo Association still floundered in debt in 1906 and then had to be bailed out by the Belgian state at a huge cost to the Belgian taxpayer, by which Belgium thus more or less involuntarily obtained a territory 25 times the size of Belgium. Even more impressive was the accomplishment of the Third French Republic, for France indeed started from practically nothing. During the Wars of the Revolution and Napoleon, France had lost all its colonies, barring two malaria-infested outposts nobody else wanted or cared to have. The castle of Saint-Louis on Gorée Island, offshore the village of Dakar, and the island of Nosy Bay off the coast of Madagascar. From such inconspicuous beginnings in the late 19th century, and within a mere 20 years, France conquered an empire larger than and with likely the same population as that of Alexander the Great, and that with far fewer people, and surely with far smaller loss of lives. The African army, basically a group of rejects from the continental French army, was seldom more than 5,000 men strong, and the one in Indochina had less than 2,000 French soldiers. Perhaps some total 1,000 French lives were lost during the conquest of that vast empire, and that still mostly of the seas. For like in most colonial armies, in the 19th century French one was far more likely to be felt by a mosquito bite than by an enemy bullet or assegai. though the hardcore of France's colonial army was the famed Foreign Legion, starting from a few hundred men recruited from Basque refugees after the Carlist Wars, and then gradually expanded to roughly 20,000 men around 1914, recruited apparently then for the more extreme elements of the Black Hundred, that is, those who had killed Jews with their own hands, and the more extreme elements of the Serbian or Bulgarian army, who too had plenty of Turkish or Bulgarian blood on their hands. These were surely all remarkable accomplishments. Yet all that was still far overshadowed by the British Empire in turn, which by 1900 was the largest empire in all of human history and was secured with even less effort, losses and costs than even the French Empire. That was admittedly not quite true for India, for half of Britain's standing army was stationed there, for which, and I'm tempted to say so that, the Indian taxpayer could foot the bill of the British army. Or, as you like it, they could not only pay their own subjugation, but that of other countries as well, such as China, for the cost of the Opium War was shouldered by India. But that was of course so for all colonial empires. The bill for their own subjugation was footed by the population of Indonesia, and that of Vietnam by that of Vietnam. The exceptions were the colonial empires of the Germans and of the Italians. One reason why the Germans were afterwards seen as exceptionally ruthless colonizers, as against the humane British, an image that has not only stuck but is also still widely taught unto the present, was that the German taxpayer was supposed to pay that empire. The colonial budget had thus to be discussed in the Reichstag, and so far more colonial dirty laundry was hung out in the German parliament than was the case elsewhere. Yet, if there was a large British contingent in India, the army that secured West Africa for the British consisted of perhaps 1,000 English and Scotsmen, and the King's African Rifles in East Africa of merely a few hundred. Now, while at first sight the simultaneous foundation of national states in Europe and that of multinational empires beyond Europe was a paradox, that really only became a very major issue as the League of Nations in the 20s of the 20th century, as the name implies, made the sovereign nation state to the cornerstone of the entire international order. There was in fact a close relationship between the formation of national states in Europe and the erection of those large ramshackle conglomerates. In the terminology of that era, a strong manly race, to use the equally misogynist as racist jargon that was then in sway, although people in the 19th century often talked about race where we would now use the word nationality instead, had a duty, once it had reached its full maturity in its own nation state, and would thus partake in all the blessings of the civilization club, to look beyond the borders of the national state. It had to colonize less civilized and less mature people than itself to bring them the blessings of civilization, technology, the railway or the post stamp, and of course the superior Christian faith. And as to the political form of organization, though there was admittedly a group of officials around Lord Lucar in Nigeria who wanted to preserve pure Africans from the evils of the modern age and modern democracy in which working class riff-raff had attained the fort in particular, most thought that for the time being Indians, Indonesians or Africans had to be under the benevolent despotism of colonial officials before those people had attained the maturity to democratically rule themselves. The officials were somewhat dubious how long that process of growing up was going to take, but it was commonly rated at several centuries. Since, after all, the consensus at the time, both amongst the public and amongst anthropologists, who worked with the gradation from the most primitive to the most advanced races, the latter one of course being the European bourgeoisie, was that people in Asia lived somewhere in the European Middle Ages, and that most West Africans, with the exception of the Hausa, who had vaguely feudal-like institutions and therefore perhaps lived in the early Middle Ages, hovered in the Bronze Age, and especially backward people, such as stateless agriculturists like the Kikuyu in Kenya, lived in the time of the caveman, while finally hunter-gatherers in Africa, such as the Khoisan or Hottentots, were generally classed at the time as natural men, half chimpanzees or gorillas. And one of the ironies of the late 19th century was that, as they gradually and very reluctantly were admitted by Europeans into the civilized nation club, this entire superior civilization terminology was assimilated by the yet very non-European Japanese as well, as they also began to speak about the sacred duty of the mature people of Japan to spread their superior Shinto religion, their great Japanese culture and their superior Japanese social organization to such primitives as the Koreans, and indeed, some argued, the Chinese. Although, to most Japanese, the common argument amongst Europeans at the time that the Chinese were a culturally and racially backward people was hard to swallow. They rather argued it was the duty of Japan to raise sleeping Chinese culture from the somnolence it had fallen into somewhere in the 13th century, as Japan had ceased to emulate Chinese writing or culture. Furthermore, colonial conquest was closely related to nationalism. That was partly since easy military victories in the colonies then caused the same kind of nationalist enthusiasm as victories of the national football team might nowadays. So that several countries started colonial adventures partly or even only to bolster national feelings in a very similar way as many politicians now hope for a victory of the national football team to distract from all kinds of social ills. And this not in the least, of course, bolstered the prestige of the politicians themselves, with all those kind of jolly colonial little or frontier wars that preferably cost no casualties on our side, while the uncivilized fuzzy-wuzzies were conveniently slaughtered. The classic case here is German imperialism, that, according to a classic study by German historian Hans-Ulrich Wehler, Bismarck und der Imperialismus, was largely intended as a distraction from all the urgent social problems thrown up by an exceptionally rapid, ruthless and brutal industrialization and urbanization, and that was meant to bolster the authoritarian regime of Bismarck at home as well, policy for which Wehler coined the term social imperialism. But social imperialism was not merely found in Germany. And Germany is perhaps not even the best case either. For if Germany incidentally eventually made a net loss on its colonies, that was not yet clear to the business, the politicians, or the broader public in the 1880s, when all had visions of Africa, or even of New Guinea, as a land of plenty. So that social imperialism was surely not the only motive involved. A far better case is Spain, that after having been badly defeated by the USA in 1898, started a war in Morocco in 1906 merely to bolster its national prestige by some easy colonial victories, and thus to keep those liberal politicians in power who were threatened to the left by the anarchist movement and to the right by an increasingly restive army. Though eventually, after 17 years of grueling and cruel guerrilla fighting in the Moroccan Rif, Spain lost that war in Morocco and had to be bailed out by the French. While in Spain itself, the Moroccan War brought the authoritarian dictatorship of General Primo de Rivera to power. Similarly so, the Russian conquest of Samarkand, Bukhara and Tashkent by the Russian Transcaucasian Army in the 1860s should likely be seen against the background of the very recent defeat of the Russian army in the Crimean War, after which it badly needed to bolster its prestige by some easy victories in Central Asia. For although the Russian textile industry needed a source of cotton nearer home than the USA and Egypt, and Central Asia was partly conquered too to obtain markets for Russian industrial products, Russia sum total made a loss on its Central Asian possessions. Finally, and above all, the entire colonial expansion of France in the 1880s and 1890s must be seen against the background of France's defeat in the 1870 war with Germany, after which military humiliation, the army badly needed to cleanse its tarnished military record. France, after all, had always imagined itself as Europe's strongest military power ever since the Battle of Rocroi in the 17th century. And incidentally, Otto von Bismarck cheered all that French colonial expansionism. He had rather seen the French foster all their energy on conquering Hanoi and Timbuktu than on taking Strasbourg back from Germany. And there was the Paris Commune. And that was so in two ways. First, the Commune had made it plain large parts of the French population did not trust the new liberal parliamentary regime, whether as a class enemy or on the side of the revanchist right, as they thought the regime of the Third Republic was too cowardly and weak to break proper revenge on Germany. An idea that was particularly widespread amongst the military, and that eventually issued in an abortive attempt to a coup by General Georges Boulanger in 1889. So that such politicians at the time, as Prime Minister Jules Ferry, needed to show they could act quickly and decisively by successful military exploits in the colonies. And perhaps too, they were only too glad to get rid of some of those militaristic ultras by dumping them in Timbuktu or Hanoi. Small wonder, the colonial army always stood on the right and the extreme right in France, as incidentally did the colonial administration as well, as much as the Pieds Noirs colonists in Algeria, as well as the admittedly rare French settlers in West Africa, the Petit Blanc. And second, the trauma which the bloodbath of the Commune left behind, and all the divisions within French society it had revealed could be mended, or at least be temporarily pampered over, by the national celebrations over the spate of French colonial acquisitions in the 80s and 90s, so that even Paris workers, who all too well remembered the horrors of the Commune, might occasionally still revel in all that new blue on the map of the world. Although that the literature argues colonial enthusiasm was never very great in France, particularly amongst the working classes, may well be related to the workers not being so easily fooled. Unlike amongst the British working class, where there was a genuine empire enthusiasm by the late 19th century, provided, that is, the empire cost nothing. And this is perhaps the most important thing to always remember about the British Empire. It was popular at home, provided it was always and everywhere run on a shoestring budget. Furthermore, colonial expansion could also further the consolidation of national states, in the very direct sense of jobs for the boys. As I've already pointed out, if there is one single region that has profited from the British Empire, it is Scotland. So that, for example, a list of Indian viceroys is a kind of Know Your Scottish Geography lesson. And that was to some extent even true for Ireland, so that up to half of all soldiers in India were Irish. Ireland has thus the rather singular position of being at once very close to a colony itself, and then being a willing, nay, an enthusiastic accomplice to the colonization of other countries. Yet in the German, the French, and even the Italian and Belgian cases too, personnel for the colonial administrations and armies came disproportionately from the poorer regions of the country. For there were few prospects for other careers for people who had absorbed secondary education or a military academy there than careers in the colonies. For it was never the first choice. Yet such modest prospects for employ still served to tie them to the national state, and it kept them from becoming the kind of disgruntled intellectuals that were the cadres of the nationalist movement in the Habsburg Empire. Thus, for example, the entire administration of the French colony of Volta in the 20s was done in Corsica, France's most disadvantaged region, and the population of which such observers from Paris as Guy de Maupassant ranged several steps below the Algerian Arabs and perhaps closest to the Dinka. And so too, much of the Italian colonial administration was derived from Sicily, and most of that of the Congo was Flemish, although the administration there continued to pretend Belgium was an entirely French-speaking country right up to the 1950s, when the Flaminghamte made an effort to export Belgium's linguistic division to the Congo. And it was indirectly so, as colonial expansion offered juicy opportunities for government contracts to provincial industrialists and to a provincial bourgeoisie, who might otherwise, much as happened in Hungary, have turned to a local nationalist movement. For as Wehler underlined, colonial expansion was both a kind of contra-cyclical policy, in which governments tried to stimulate the economy by government contracts for building, say, railroads or harbors in Cameroon, which, as it was far away anyway, would not hurt any vested interest at home, and a way of diverting away an economic dynamism that could lead to social and economic struggles at home to some distant place. So, it is probably not too far-fetched to argue that class cause building of train industry owes everything to government contracts for constructing railroads in India and later on in South and East Africa, and that its shipbuilding owes everything to such heavily government-subsidized official shipping lines as the Cunard Line for shipping to India, or for shipping to China, the Scottish Mackinnon shipping conglomerate. A conglomerate that incidentally was also the driving force behind the British expansion in East Africa, as it was the main financier of the British East Africa Company that ran Kenya and Uganda until 1900. So too, Italian colonial expansion, out a lot, and I'm tempted to say everything, to the bankers and ship owners of one single city. And in the light of all that I have said about that city before, is hardly a cause for surprise, namely Genoa. Italian colonialism started by the need for the Genoese ship owners to secure a coaling station under Italian control in the Red Sea, for which they fixed on a small port called Massawa, and the hinterland of which was later on proclaimed to be the Italian colony of Eritrea. And the driving force behind German colonial expansion was the Bourse Sea of Hamburg, a place that, as I said before, even now is not quite certain it really belongs to Germany, and that either as they saw themselves secluded from market after market in Africa by the British Empire, behind of which of course stood Mackinnon, or as they complained, they suffered from unfair competition of African intermediary traders. And so they began to plead to the government of Prussia, and then to that of the German Empire, they needed colonies as well, either to push out those African intermediaries, or, since in that case, the government could allow the shipping of troops, supplies and goods to the colonies on the government contracts to them. Now actually, the main reason for colonialism was quite simple, and it has never been up to much question amongst historians. It was simply that the colonial war and colonial expansion was not that expensive for the metropolis, and mostly it was gratis. The colonies, after all, paid their own subjugation, as I've said already, and they paid handsome pensions for the few thousand people who worked there besides, what the British euphemistically called home charges, to wit, that some dirt poor peasant in Ghana or Bihar would finance the cost of a villa for some former colonial official in Surrey, or some peasant in Jaffa one for a colonial official in Arnhem, as the colonialist retired at 45, and there were few administrative services which offered such generous and early pensions as the India and Colonial Office in the British and the Binnenlands Bestuur van Nederlands Indië in the Dutch case. More importantly, colonial wars cost few or no casualties. So few casualties as to be deemed acceptable by both politicians and the public at large. Acceptable, of course, is relative. The 240 Dutch casualties on 25,000 Achinese people killed, the Netherlands suffered during the Aceh War in the beginning of the 20th century on 2 million people, were then apparently seen as acceptable, while they would be rated a national disaster nowadays, as were indeed the 1,400 casualties the US suffered in the war on the Philippines, on at least 240,000 Filipinos, and the 800 it suffered in the Iraq War were seen as a national catastrophe as well, as is partly, perhaps, as Israeli political scientist Edward Luckbach suggests, as families had more children, 4 or 5 on average, in 1900, as against only 1 or 2 nowadays, and more children died at birth too. And it is arguably easier to put up with the death of a child if you've 8, and if 2 more have died at birth, than if it is your only child. But it was likely above all, as deadly incidents at work were the rule in the 19th and early 20th century, compared to the nearly 2,000 people yearly killed in Britain in mine incidents alone, a yearly colonial casualty list of less than 1,000 was a comparatively light burden to bear for an empire on which the sun never set. And as the colonial armies were of course professional armies, there were far more dangerous jobs for unskilled workers than becoming a soldier in one. Fisherman, say, sailor or miner. given that all that cost so little money and so few lives, it was only too tempting to engage for governments in colonial preemption. You had to snatch territory before some European rival laid a claim to it. 4. In the beginning of the 19th century, European colonial armies were in India, in Indonesia, and even in West Africa, not that technologically more advanced than their Indian, their Javanese, or even their Gold Coast Ashanti foes. The latter, in fact, defeated the British in 1824, so that they had subsequently to seek some hasty arrangement with them, for whatever ills the slave trade had otherwise. It had put reasonably advanced fire weapons, though no artillery, in the hands of African kings. But as the slave trade began to gradually peter out in the 1860s, and European states signed mutual treaties prohibiting further sales of weapons to Africans by the 1870s, African armies in West Africa found themselves opposing new European rapid fire bolt action rifles equipped European forces, accurate at 40 feet distance, with at best old needle guns dating from the 1840s, and at worst with old muskets dating from the golden age of the slave trade in the beginning of the 19th century. And they found out to their sorrow that infantry advancing in lines to bring those old muskets to bear in the 18th century fashion was dead, much as the Confederate and Union soldiers time and time over again experienced during the Civil War. While in East Africa, where firearms had not been peddled in quantity, the Africans had famously only bows, assegais and arrows and were mowed down by the European armies without any loss. Yet Hiram Maxim still noted proudly and rightly that it was not the dash of the officers or the skill of the soldiers that had won the Battle of Omdurman for the British, or indeed Africa for the Europeans, as rather the invention of a quiet, scientific gentleman living in Kent. In Nigeria, 6 Maxim machine guns and 7 artillery pieces defeated the mighty army of the Nupe in 1897. 2 artillery pieces and 4 Maxims sufficed for the powerful Sultanate of Ilorin in the same year. And in 1903, the British attracted the prize, mighty Sokoto, with 700 African riflemen, 25 European soldiers and 5 Maxims. Hordes of horses and footmen armed with swords, spears, old guns, as that ground exploit was described at the time, and bows and arrows appeared. They charged time and time over again, only to be mown down by machine gun and carbine fire. The battle was over in less than 2 hours, after which the survivors fled the city. In other words, colonial empires were simply acquired because conquering them was neither very costly in lives, nor very risky, and as the conquest was ideally practically greatest too. All this has never been disputed. And debates about colonialism and academia have therefore rather been fostered on an endless discussion on what the causes were of imperialism. Basically, an extended debate, pro and con, on Lenin's brilliant little brochure, Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism, from 1916. Arguably, together with Mein Kampf, the single most influential piece of political writing of the 20th century. The Marxist argued that imperialism, defined by the Standard Dictionary of Webster as the policy, practice or advocacy of extending the power and dominion of a nation, especially by direct territorial acquisitions or by gaining indirect control over the political or economic life of other areas, was an integral part of capitalism. For, argued Lenin, quote, monopoly has grown out of colonial policy. To the numerous old motives of colonial policy, financial capital has added the struggle for the sources of raw materials, for the export of capital, for the spheres of influence, for the spheres for profitable deals, concessions, monopoly profits, and so on, and for economic territory in general. When the colonies of European powers, for instance, comprised only 1/10 of the territory of Africa, colonial policy was able to develop by methods other than those of monopoly, by free grabbing of territories. But when 9/10 of Africa had been seized by 1900, when the whole world had been divided up, there inevitably ushered in the era of monopoly possession of colonies, and consequently of particularly intense struggle for the division and for the redivision of the world. Monopolies, Lenin pursued, oligarchy, the striving for domination and not for freedom, the exploitation of an increasing number of small or weak nations by a handful of richest and most powerful, all these have given birth to those distinctive characteristics of imperialism that compel us to define it as parasitic capitalism. More and more prominently, there emerges, as one of its tendencies, the creation of the rentier state, the usurer state, in which the bourgeoisie, to an ever-increasing degree, lives on the proceeds of capital exports and clipping coupons. It would be a mistake to believe that this tendency to decay precludes the rapid growth of capitalism. On the whole, capitalism is growing far more rapidly than before. But this growth is not only becoming more and more uneven in general, its unevenness also manifests itself in the decay of countries which are richest in capital, and that means Britain. Now, one has to merely remember that Britain is nowadays practically devoid of industry and lives off what is officially called services, but might equally well be called coupon clipping, to see why Lenin's brochure has been so singularly influential. With the communists arguing, imperialism led to violent international rivalries, and that those rivalries bred war in turn, non-communist or anti-communist historians then try to show capitalism and imperialism were not related at all. For capitalism is all about the peaceful acquisition of new markets, they argue. And if there is one thing capitalists detest, it is the insecurity of investments that is engendered by international rivalries, whereas military expansion instead favors other groups, who are rather opposed to the new industrial bourgeoisie, such as the landed nobility. All this in the vein pioneered by Austrian economist Joseph Schumpeter in the 1920s, to whom imperialist expansion was a violent, feudal, atavist tendency within an otherwise peaceful capitalist society. So that, to him, the imperialist countries were such semi-feudal residuals as Austria-Hungary and Germany, while the most capitalist countries, such as the USA and above all Britain, and presumably Belgium and the Netherlands even more so, were surely not imperialistic at all. Now, this is obviously an odd statement, as Schumpeter must have realized if he had taken only one single look at all the British red, Belgian yellow, or Dutch orange on the world map in his own day and age. But then Schumpeter was primarily trying to cast the German and Austrian empires in the role of culprits to World War I, rather than that he was concerned with imperialism per se, let alone with the causes for the division of Africa, the typical bone of contention in the imperialism discussion in academia. At any rate, Tempting as that view might be of colonial expansion as driven by the aristocracy that dominated the European armies into the 20th century, there is no real support for it. As I said already, both colonial officials and officers came overwhelmingly from the professional and petite bourgeoisie. If there are groups particularly associated with colonialism, it were not nobles so much as teachers, clergymen, and indeed professors for the officials. And the petite bourgeoisie, shopkeepers, bartenders, and so on, for the officers. Whereas the rank and file of colonial armies was of course working class, and they came primarily from the rural laborers, whose employment was badly hit by the agricultural crisis of the 80s. Though admittedly, most colonial armies, the German ones one excepted, paid that rank and file very badly, and they primarily enlisted for adventure and to see the world. In an age where the average manual laborer in, say, Liverpool or Manchester could afford, if he was very lucky, to stay 5 days on holiday in Blackpool a year, or one from Amsterdam, say, 5 days in Zandvoort, only the colonial army offered opportunities for sightseeing, government-paid trips down the Nile, say, or by packet boat, admittedly in the hold, for the soldiers of the Royal Dutch Indian Army to such picture book paradises at Bali. And yet, I say it is tempting to subscribe to Schumpeter's view, since the culture those colonialists of mainly petty bourgeois extraction then erected amongst themselves in the colonies was a replica of the European aristocratic ancien regime of the 18th century, and of the very worst kind, including that kind of groveling of the baser sort of people for their betters that had become distinctly démodé in Europe, of the natives of course, but of the lower classes as well. Now, it is probably no coincidence that this discussion about imperialism amongst historians raised vehemently in the 60s and 70s. For while ostentatiously being mainly a rather arcane technical debate focused on the motives of various European governments for the division of Africa in the 1880s, this discussion hardly coincidentally coincided in time with the war in Vietnam, that, to recall, nearly ripped American society asunder and led to waves of protest in Europe as well. The Marxist historians argued, completely in accordance with the official line of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, that capitalism fostered international rivalries and was thus inherently warlike. That was proven by the division of Africa as much as, since the mantle of leading imperialist power had now passed from Britain to the USA, the war in Vietnam. The non-Marxist argued that the division of Africa owed nothing to the capitalists. Rather, it owed everything to a, right or wrong, policy of the British, German or French government in the 80s. In the British case, this involved the supposed defense of India by securing all shores of the Indian Ocean. In the French case, the government, as it were, tried to take revenge for the British annexation of Egypt by annexing West Africa in turn. And this in turn prompted preemption of the British by securing the upper reaches of the Niger and annexing Ashanti before the French showed up there. While in the German case, it involved securing colonial bargaining chips to be bartered away for more useful European territory later, as with Zanzibar, that the Germans swept for Helgoland. And so too, they might then very similarly argue, Vietnam was not due to the capitalist system, as rather to a series of right or wrong decisions of the Kennedy or Johnson administrations. All this offered hopeful lessons for the future, such erroneous policies would not be repeated again. Now, Partly, this entire debate began to look increasingly worn out and stale by the 90s, as the same old arguments about the economic or not motives for imperialism were being repeated time and time over again. And the historians shifted instead to studying colonial culture, the so-called post-colonial studies, and studying subaltern groups, such as homosexuals or women in the colonies. And yet, the relationship between big business, foreign offices and the military remains an issue of no minor significance. And with all the proliferation of studies on, say, queer and prostitutes in the British Empire, or the so manyth interpretation of Conrad's Heart of Darkness, which now appear by the dozens, we have only one study on the relation between Britain's military-industrial complex and British foreign policy. And as far as I know, there's not a single one about France. It was partly too, as the memories of all the bitter controversies about Vietnam gradually faded amongst academics as much as amongst the general public, and particularly after the decision of the Bush administration to attack Iraq, the imperialism discussion was gradually displaced by a new discourse, one that I might call the Empires in World History discourse, to quote just one such study by Frederick Cooper and Jane Burbank. To an extent, this has been useful in at least ridding us of this eternal economic motives or not discussion and establishing a far longer pedigree in time of modern imperialism. Now, the essence of this discourse was summed up by protagonist Marlowe's monologue on a ship on the Thames in Hearts of Darkness. Quote, "I was thinking of very old times, when the Romans first came here, 1900 years ago. Imagine the feelings of a commander of a fine trireme in the Mediterranean, ordered suddenly to the north, run over land across the Gauls in a hurry, put in charge of one of these crafts, the legionaries, a wonderful lot of handy men they must have been, used to build, apparently by the hundreds, in a month or two. Imagine him here, the very end of the world, a sea the color of lead, a sky the color of smoke, a kind of ship about as rigid as a concertina, and going up this river, with stores or orders or what you like. Sandbanks, marshes, forests, savages, preciously little to eat, fit for a civilized man. Nothing but Thames water to drink. They must have been dying like flies here. Oh yes, they did it. Did it very well too, no doubt. And without thinking much about it either, except afterwards to brag of what he has gone through in his times, perhaps. They were men enough to face the darkness. Mind, none of us now would feel exactly like this. What saves us is efficiency, a devotion to efficiency. But these chaps were not of much account, really. There were no colonists. Their administration was merely a squeeze, and nothing more, I suspect. They were conquerors, and for that you only want brute force, nothing to boast of when you have it, since your strength is just an accident, arising from the weakness of others. They grabbed what they could get, for the sake of what was to be caught. It was just robbery with violence, aggravated murder on a great scale, and men going at it blind, as is very proper for those who tackle the darkness. The conquest of the earth, which mostly means the taking it away from those who have a different complexion or slightly flat noses than ourselves, is not a pretty thing when you look into it too much. What redeems it is the idea only, an idea at the back of it, not a sentimental pretense, but an idea, an unselfish belief in the idea, something you can set up to and bow down for, a sacrifice to. So the argument here too is that the British, French or Dutch or Belgian empires of the 19th century much as the USA's empire of the 21st century, a part of a long and distinguished group, one that, via the Romans, goes down the ages all the way from the Assyrian or Persian empires in antiquity. Robbery and aggravated murder on a large scale, sure, but always redeemed by an ideal. Efficiency, or Pax Romana, or Pax Belgica in Congo, and Pax Britannica, an idea one can bow down before. All those empires shared very similar characteristics, as opposed to the national states or city-states, although writers on empires in world history are often not very clear what they contrast their empires to. Thus, for example, empires valued diversity as opposed to the monoculturalism that is fostered by the national state, and they tend to be highly decentralized, to offer local officials considerable leeway, from the Persian satraps to the colonial officials and soldiers on the spot, as it was known at the time in the 19th century, such as Commander Rivière, who despite explicit orders from Paris to avoid le coup de fusil, stormed the citadel of Hanoi in 1883 on his own initiative. As the government was foolish enough to send me 500 men, I set out to accomplish on my own what it lacked the nerve to make me do, he argued. They will now be forced to carry on. And so down to the modern US Army commands, who just like Rivière can make their own decisions without even consulting the State Department. And empires leave their regions considerable administrative, cultural and religious autonomy, unlike the single culture, language and religion that are imposed by a national state. Indeed, in a protectorate of one of those empires, citizens might hardly notice they are under its rule at all, as the local government is merely bound by some treaties to the empire and advised by what in the 19th century would have been called a political resident. While all authorities are locally named, and nominal culture and religion is still entirely the local one. So the only way of noting one belongs to the empire at all is the increasing pervasiveness of imperial customs and language that the local elites try to ape as much as possible. All this would apply as much to the Roman protectorate of Palestine in the age of Christ, which was to its inhabitants, mind you, not ruled by the Roman political resident Pontius Pilatus, as rather by King Herodes Antipas, as to the emirates of the Persian Gulf in the 19th century, that were formally independent, but had to accept the constant meddling of a British political resident in their external affairs. Or it might apply to areas under very indirect rule in the British Empire, such as the kingdoms bound by what was called a subsidiary alliance to Britain. For example, Uganda's Baganda Kingdom and the Kor Ashanti Kingdom around Kumasi, in both of which, to most inhabitants, the Kabaka or the Ashantehene were in power and were merely advised by a British resident. All this was by and large invisible to the inhabitants, and the number of Englishmen in Kampala or Kumasi was seldom more than a dozen, so that people in Kampala and Kumasi could both be forgiven for thinking they still lived entirely under Baganda and Ashanti rather than under British rule, and both actually featured movements in the 1950s called Kabaka Yeka in Uganda and National Liberation Movement in Kumasi that resisted a possible independence. Since they did not want to replace their beloved king, whom the British had after all always paid homage to, with some upstart government, one that would put the beloved king likely on a far tighter leash than the British ever did. And some cynics might surely add the Netherlands, in relation to the USA nowadays, to their list of protectorates. Now historians obviously have widely divergent views on whether or not empire is a good thing, and on whether, therefore, the USA should follow that good or bad example. On one side there is the, as they call themselves, Empire Club, who argue that empires are efficient in Conrad's sense. They are indispensable for keeping orders in a chaotic world, and by maintaining that order, they foster and fuel international investments that alone can lead to economic development, hence general prosperity of the population and even as economic development fosters the development of a middle class to parliamentary democracy. This was the function the British Empire in their field fulfilled in the 19th century, and it was, despite a few local glitches, still a positive one. And it is a role that the one indispensable power, as Madeleine L. Albright famously called it, the USA should fulfill nowadays. Now, aside from that, the conquest of the world is never a very pleasant thing if you come too closely to all those glitches the Empire Club happily passes over. There is a problem with that view which British or American historians too often ignore. And that is that despite what they often think, the British Empire was not the only great power of the 19th century. On the European continent, it played a rather marginal role, as it had hardly any army to speak of, or more precisely, its entire army was stationed in India, as witnessed by Bismarck's famous quip in the time of the Schleswig-Holstein crisis in the 60s, that if the British army was to land in Germany, he would send a sheriff to arrest it. Neither was the British Empire outside of Europe the only power, and that even in the period its position was not really challenged by France any longer, when the Spanish Empire had collapsed and the European powers had together temporarily dismantled the world's traditional paramount power, namely China. That is roughly from 1830 to 1880. On the American continent, the British had obviously to count with the USA. And with all the celebrations of the supposed eternal bonding between the two Anglo-Saxon brother nations, the United Kingdom and the USA, up to roughly the 1870s, those relations were tense, to say the least. For the USA's administration had been harboring hopes of annexing Canada from the American Revolution right up to the 70s, after which they gradually settled on what they called convergence. As Canada was invaded by American money and culture, it would become so much like the USA that there would be no need to annex it any longer, as it was already a state of the Union, without being called thus. Any Canadian listener may figure out whether they have succeeded in that. The British had perforce to conclude by the 70s there was no way they could defend Canada against the USA. And since there was no way Britain could challenge the USA, they better give way to US demands on at least the American continent, as in the Anglo-American dispute over the borders of Alaska, that was, the Canadians' complaint, entirely settled to the USA's favor. In Asia, the big challenge was from Russia, and in the purely local context of Southeast Asia, there were the Dutch, whom the administration of India saw as arch enemy throughout the early 19th century, so that they tried to demolish Dutch trade by establishing a free port in the middle of all territory claimed by the Dutch, called Singapore. Whereas later on, the administration in Singapore encouraged freebooter James Brooke, who in the 40s founded a kind of smuggler kingdom in the middle of territory claimed by the Dutch. He called it Sarawak, and it was in the 50s of the 20th century, to the great anger of the government of Indonesia, joined with the Federated States of Malaysia. All this, however much Whitehall tried to discourage such a rivalry with the Dutch, as Whitehall wanted to keep them a neutral power in Europe and foresaw them leaning to either France or Prussia. And in Africa, in turn, there was the old Portuguese ally, whom the administration in Westminster tried successfully to dissuade from their idea of linking Mozambique to Angola by conquering the dimly known lands lying in between those two, until, to the fury of the Portuguese, in the 90s they found an English block squeezed in between their territories, one that was acquired by a supposedly private company arranged by Cecil Rhodes, the so-called British South Africa Company. Yet the Portuguese suspected that whole thing was merely a cover organization for the British government, and that company, by all kind of to the Portuguese completely spurious treaties with local rulers, then fabricated an entire country, the Central African Federation, or what was then called Rhodesia and Nyasaland. Yet the British could more or less dictate terms to the government of Portugal, as that government then, as much as now, had a tendency to spend far more than it got in, and it thus had constantly to beg for money in the city of London, and thus ultimately with the government in Whitehall. The British government could always make the Portuguese one more pliant in colonial affairs by threatening to withdraw its loans. So that finally in 1890, after the British ultimatum to withdraw, Portugal had to acquiesce to the existence of Rhodesia. It was one reason for the toppling of the Portuguese monarchy by a coup in 1910. And though they had less financial leverage over the Dutch, the British could at least try persuading them that what the British saw as their best interests were truly their best interests. However much, the colonial government in Batavia saw the British as their main rival and signed all kind of what was called in the language of the time preemptive treaties with princes in the Indonesian archipelago. Treaties that prohibited them from having intercourse with any other nation than the Dutch. All this largely intended to keep the British out. While I think the British signed very similar treaties with the various rajas along the Straits of Malacca that were eventually to amalgamate into the United States of Malaysia in the 90s, primarily to keep the Dutch out as well. Yet, despite this local Anglo-Dutch Cold War in the Indonesian archipelago, this policy of persuading the Dutch eventually worked, so that the Dutch and the British in 1871 settled the so-called Sumatra Treaty, in which the British swapped their old settlement in Sumatra, Bengkulu, with Dutch Elmina Castle on the Gold Coast. And they recognized Sumatra as an exclusively Dutch sphere of influence, in return for the Dutch government henceforth confining the recruitment of contract laborers for Suriname exclusively to British India, rather than, as the Dutch had done before, recruiting them in Java. Stated bluntly, the Dutch agreed to act as a kind of British imperial subcontractor and not disturb them in Africa any longer, while they got carte blanche from the British to conquer the entire Indonesian archipelago in return. This incidentally led to a crisis and ultimately to a war, not merely in Aceh, but on the Gold Coast as well, as the Ashanti had always been Dutch allies, whereas the British had backed the rival Fanti. So that as the Dutch government more or less delivered the Ashanti up to the British, they decided to, as it were, preemptively attack the Fanti, lest they got too strong. Yet while the British could bully the Portuguese, with the French in Africa, and of course even more so with the Russians in Central Asia, such kind of deals did not work. There were fierce local rivalries between British agents in Afghanistan or in Persia with the Russians, summarized as the Great Game for the control of Central Asia, and the typical stuff of spy and adventure novels in the 19th century, tensions that admittedly occasionally heated up, but they were never really that important that either government was prepared to come to blows over it. So the British government more or less gave the Russians the free hand to annex Bukhara, Kokand and Giwa, while the two governments eventually settled on an arrangement in the 80s in which the Emirate of Afghanistan was to become a neutral buffer state between Russian conquests and British India. And the Emirate was strengthened by allotting a territory to the west Herat, that Persia traditionally claimed as part of its territory. And it was allotted an Uzbek-speaking territory in the north besides, that was traditionally part of the Emirate of Bukhara, one that has resented Pathan-dominated Kabul ever since. Similarly, though far less noisily than was the case with the Great Khan in Central Asia, the British and the French governments engaged in a kind of Great Khan of their own, over whom was to control Egypt from the mid-19th century, until finally the British government unilaterally adjudicated the matter by force by proclaiming that Egypt was henceforth to become a British protectorate in 1882, more or less in return for which the British condoned a French annexation of Tunisia and more or less silently too gave the French army carte blanche in West Africa, where the British colonies ultimately became the specks of English-speaking territory enclosed within a vast French-speaking bloc that they have remained up to the present. Though it is but fair to add that the English with Nigeria also secured by far the most valuable piece of territory in West Africa, and indeed next to South Africa in all of Africa, whereas the French territories mostly consisted of deserts or semi-desert. And up to 1920s, the French were really at a loss what commercial or other uses to make of these newly acquired African colonies. In other words, rather than that the British acted as Albright's one indispensable power in the world that tried everywhere to unilaterally impose its own will and its own stability, as the modern fans of the British Empire now like to perceive it, the British not only completely surrendered to the USA and acquiesced in the existence of a great many local subcontractors, such as the Dutch in Southeast Asia and the Belgians and very crushingly so the Portuguese in Africa, but silently acquiesced too in the existence of several regional policemen. Policemen who might then impose their own perceived version of superior Western civilization in their sphere of interest. Russia and Central Asia, France in Africa and Indochina, where the problem of course was Germany, that bitterly resented this USA, French, Russian, British division of the world. That is a role of local policemen, in other words. The USA presently, just like the British before them, condones for France in sub-Saharan Africa, as in the recent intervention in Mali that the US government immediately conceded as being a French affair, but that it definitely will not allow Russia to play in the former USSR sphere of interest or China in Southeast Asia, which only goes to prove the old verity that if people draw lessons from history, they are invariably the wrong lessons. Next to all those fans of empire, there are of course also its critics, such as Timothy Parsons recently, in a study with the revealing title The Rule of Empires, Those Who Built Them, Those Who Endured Them, and Why They Never Last. Parsons argues that though they always argue they do, empires were never ever built to benefit those who had to endure them. They only benefited a tiny metropolitan elite, and ideally, and only to some degree, metropolitan proletarians. To the rest of their subjects, imperial rule has always meant denigration and exploitation, so that empires invariably collapsed again. The US Marines in Nasiriyah or Fallujah simply stood in the footsteps of the British in Kenya, the Roman legionaries, or before that, Alexander the Great's phalanxes in Palestine, 2,500 years ago. I mention this on purpose, as perhaps the most striking indictment of colonial rule by a subject people ever is the Old Testament in general and the Book of Ezra in particular. As some colonial authorities occasionally worried, the Bible, if wrongly read, might prove a dangerously subversive book. that Africans began by 1900 to convert to Christianity by the thousands, the tens of thousands, and then the millions, has many different causes. But perhaps the main one is the simplest. They converted because the Bible had a direct appeal to them. For perhaps the best description of how the Africans experienced their own colonization is Ezra book 5, quote, "Let the farmers that till the ground mourn, because their seed shall fail, and their trees shall be ruined by blight and hail, and by terrible tempest. Alas for the world and for those who live in it. The sword and misery draw near them. Nations shall rise up to fight against nations, with sword in hand. A man shall have no pity upon his neighbors, but shall make an assault upon their houses with the sword, and plunder their goods, because of hunger for bread, and because of great tribulation." Rather than merely a small local clique, the period of the division of Africa was an unmitigated disaster, of which the continent has economically, socially, and even mentally not really recovered right up to the present. Much as was the case for the American Indians with the Spanish conquest, from which they have not recovered in 500 years. Fast tracks in East Africa, such as the famed Maasai, and Serengeti, are now seemingly pristine nature reserves because the population was thinned out and often nearly wiped out during the period of the colonial conquest, whether by human diseases or by rinderpest. 1892, the year of the Great Dying, as the Maasai call it, featured for example a rinderpest epidemic in the Serengeti, in which the herds of the nomadic Maasai died off, and the people were starved or reduced to beggary with the herds. As one observer described it, quote, "There were women reduced to walking skeletons, out of whose sunken eyes looked the madness of hunger. Children resembling deformed frogs rather than human beings. Warriors who could hardly crawl on all fours, and moronic greybeards. These people ate everything available. Dead donkeys were a delicacy to them. But they also devoured the skins, bones, and even horns of cattle. Swarms of vultures followed them, waiting for victims." Next, these depopulated areas were proclaimed protected game reserves by the colonial government, to which access was henceforth barred to their former inhabitants. Big game hunting, after all, was something reserved for only the very richest and the most powerful, such as US President Theodore Roosevelt, who after his term as president began to indulge in this odd form of tourism and has above all popularized it. And they had far more influence in parliament than some obscure herdsmen. And the situation elsewhere was worse. Fast devastations, famines as a result of both land eviction and forced labor, as well as the coincidental spread of smallpox and African sleeping sickness, have at the very least halved the population of Congo in the late 19th century. Never in its entire history has Belgium experienced a disaster of even remotely similar proportions, thus the authoritative Belgian historian Jan van Sino. In the 20s, the population of Congo had dropped from about 40 around 1850 to 50 million. Given that prodigious drop, there was talk in the 20s of following Rhodesian or South African examples, allot the land to white settlers, and lock the African population up in native reserves. But that idea stalled on protests of both the church and the big monopoly companies, who feared that the labor force, or the numbers of souls, might then decline yet further. In Gabon, the period of colonization coincided with a 30% drop of the population. As Albert Schweitzer arrived there, his steamer passed for hours along abandoned villages that a veteran colonial assured him had been densely populated 20 years previously. What caused that? Schweitzer asked. Alcohol, he replied. When the Belgians and French conquered the Congo, they had visions, and not even unrealistic ones, of a mighty rainforest under whose canopy an innumerable and laborious population is sheltering. 20 years later, they were by and large eradicated, partly by the contact with the gin and rum civilization of the European factories along the Congo, and partly too by the literally deadly work of tapping the rubber trees that the Congolese described as follows. Quote, "It used to take 10 days to gather 20 baskets of rubber. We were always in the forest, and then we were killed. We had to go further and further into the forest to go without food. And our women had to give up cultivating the fields, and then we starved. Wild beasts killed us when we were working in the forest. Others got lost or died from exposure or starvation. And we begged the white men to leave us alone. But the white men and their soldiers said, 'Go, you are only beast and meat yourself.' And then there were the epidemics. Smallpox, sleeping sickness, spreading from coast to hinterland, or syphilis. Flu alone, diffused from the European factories, may have cost the life of 1/10 of the population. As Schweitzer established his hospital in Cambon, he was assured, 'Amongst us everybody is ill. Our country devours its children.' So that the population ceased to alcohol in despair, ushering in a vicious cycle of drink and death. In Sudan, the population shrank from 8 million to at most 3 from 1880 to 1920. In Uganda, from 1 million to 600,000, and in Kenya, where the colonization coincided with one of the worst droughts in African history, from 3 million to 2 million. The populations in the deep interior of Africa in particular were devastated. As elephant hunters, to supply the booming demand for ivory on the world market, penetrated there and spread diseases like smallpox, to which local populations were seldom immune. Worse effects had the already mentioned rinderpest, afflicting cattle as much as predators, deriving originally from Asia and probably spread by zebus that the Italians had introduced in Eritrea in 1887. Some of these diseases were incidentally introduced by colonial governments. Others, such as the rapid spread of sleeping sickness, accidentally resulted from colonial policy and from the recruitment of forced labor from building railways in particular, as various populations who had so far been isolated from one another and were not immune to one another's diseases were hurled together in labor camps. It emptied entire districts in Kenya and cost hundreds of thousands of lives. Allowing for its scant financial means, the colonial government did its utmost to combat all these diseases, but with almost no success. Those epidemics have, although the link is rarely made in the literature, had two long-term impacts. On the one hand, they likely fostered the evangelization of Africa. Africans could feel that this bout of devastating epidemics meant that their gods had forsaken them, whence they were willing to try the missionaries' cures, since mission and medicine in Africa were virtually identical. And on the other hand, they facilitated the conquest of Africa. Much as happened in the Americas in the 16th century, they so disrupted societies that these easily collapsed on a slight push from abroad, as the Africans well understood. All these diseases had been concocted by the whites to seize their land, they surmised. Even after World War I, they would hence tragically still often resist inoculation campaigns of the government. Those merely served, they dreaded, to give them yet new diseases. Much as AIDS is still commonly perceived in Africa as a disease concocted by whites to kill black people. So, as William Edgar Du Bois summed it all up in 1920, quote, "Consider our chiefest industry, fighting. Laboriously, the Middle Ages built its rules of fairness, equal armament, equal notice, equal condition. What do we see today? Machine guns against assegais, conquest sugared with religion, mutilation and rape masquerading as culture. All this with vast applause at the superiority of white over black soldiers. War is horrible. This the dark world knows to its awful cost. But has it just become horrible in these last days, when under essentially equal conditions, equal armament, and equal waste of wealth, white men are fighting white men, with surgeons and nurses hovering near? Think of all the wars through which we have lived in the last decade. In German Africa, in British Nigeria, in French and Spanish Morocco, in China, in Persia, in the Balkans, in Tripoli, in Mexico, and in a dozen lesser places. There were for most of these wars no Red Cross funds. Behold little Belgium and her pitiable plight. But has the world forgotten Congo? What Belgium now suffers is not half, not even a tenth, of what she has done to Congo since Stanley's great dream of 1880. Down the dark forests of inmost Africa sailed this modern Sir Galahad, Stanley, in the name of the noble-minded men of several nations, to introduce commerce and civilization. What came of it? Rubber and murder, slavery in its worst form," wrote Clive in 1895. Harris declares that King Leopold's regime meant the death of 12 million natives, but what we, who were behind the scenes, felt most keenly was the fact that the real catastrophe in Congo was desolation and murder in the larger sense, the invasion of family life, the ruthless destruction of every social barrier, the shattering of tribal law, the introduction of criminal practices which struck the chiefs of the people down with horror. In a word, a veritable avalanche of filth and immorality overwhelmed the Congo tribes. Yet the fields of Belgium loved. The cities were gay. Art and science flourished. The crones that helped to nourish this civilization fell on deaf ears, because the world round about did the same sort of thing elsewhere on its own account.